I was not seated directly next to the president, but pretty darn close.
Alaska senators are called to the White House for a high-pressure lunch. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 19th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, how mammals in the Aleutians deal with magma.
Yeah, those animals, they've evolved with volcanoes for a long time, obviously.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. UAA is investing in Alaska by equipping students with the knowledge and tools for academic success. These students will go on to be the doctors, nurses, teachers, engineers, and artists of Alaska who shape the future of the state by bringing new solutions, inventions, and ideas to the table. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More information can be found at uaa.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAA.
President Trump summoned Republican senators to the White House for lunch today, where he pressured them to pass a health care reform bill. Just yesterday, Senator Lisa Murkowski was one of three Republicans to crush his Plan C, which was just repealing the Affordable Care Act and replacing it later. Now, the president is back to Plan B, repeal and replace, and he's impatient. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports on a meal that was definitely not just lunch.
Please sit down.
After 36 hours of open dissent to the president's stated desires, this was a table set for awkwardness. Murkowski was placed one senator away from the president on his left. West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Capito was just as near on his right side. She's another senator who said no Tuesday to repealing the ACA without a replacement.
We're in this room today to deliver on our promise to the American people to repeal Obamacare and to ensure that they have the health care that they need.
During the 10 minutes cameras were allowed at the start of a two-hour lunch, Trump promised tremendous competition in insurance markets if Republican bills become law. He promised new forms of insurance that are unimaginable now. But first, he said, senators have to get rid of the Affordable Care Act.
We can repeal it, but the best is repeal and replace, and let's get going. I intend to keep my promise, and I know you will too.
But it's not easy crafting a replacement bill that suits at least 50 GOP senators. Trump says they are close to a solution, yet 6 months into his presidency, Republicans are still scrambling for a plan that's not too mean and not too expensive for Americans or their government. And Alaska's two senators are split on how to go about it. After lunch, Murkowski said she doesn't expect any retribution for her stand on Tuesday, and she didn't feel Trump aimed any pointed barbs at her.
No. I was not seated directly next to the president, but pretty darn close.
She says she came out against a repeal-only bill because Alaskans want changes to the Affordable Care Act.
And so I said, no, we're not just going to walk away from this. We have an obligation to focus on the reform, on the fix, on the replace, whatever word it is that you want to call. People are saying, fix it.
Murkowski wants open hearings, which would give Democrats a chance to weigh in. She wants the bill to move in the classic way, through committees. She's warned it's going to take a while, and she does not want to repeal the ACA first. She says that amounts to repeal and trust us, and she says it would roil the insurance markets. At the White House lunch, Senator Dan Sullivan was seated five senators away from the president. He agrees with Trump that Republicans, working as they have among themselves, can get the job done.
You know, we're very close. Why are we giving up now? And that was the theme of this lunch.
Sullivan says the draft replacement bill, called the Better Care Reconciliation Act, already has a lot of good features, and he's still hoping for a vote on that soon.
There's a lot of elements. We're still working through it, but I think that are going to be very positive for Alaska and the country.
It's not clear that bill will be up for a vote in the near future. And first, Senate leaders may opt to take up the repeal-only bill. Sullivan has said he'd vote to move ahead with that, too. Murkowski is already a no, and she's been joined by a fourth Republican senator, Rob Portman of Ohio. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A second Mat-Su Valley Republican senator has filed for statewide office today. Senator David Wilson of Wasilla filed a letter of intent to run for lieutenant governor in the 2018 election. Wilson, a freshman senator, submitted paperwork just 2 days after fellow Wasilla Republican Senator Mike Dunleavy filed to run for governor. Both Wilson and Dunleavy had made headlines in the most recent session. Dunleavy left the Republican-controlled Senate Majority Caucus over disagreements on the state's operating budget. Wilson made news after allegedly striking Alaska Dispatch News reporter Nathaniel Herz. Wilson is the only candidate to file a letter of intent to run for lieutenant governor thus far. The Safeway supermarket chain has agreed to pay $3 million to the U.S. Attorney's Office in a settlement that involves missing pain medication from a pharmacy in Wasilla. An agreement signed Tuesday between Safeway and the Department of Justice says the Wasilla Cars Pharmacy was investigated by the Drug Enforcement Administration for failing to follow DEA protocols on reporting missing controlled substances, like opioids. This is Jody Underwood, a DEA special agent based in Seattle.
We received a loss notification from Safeway and Wasilla regarding over 12,000 tablets of hydrocodone. Our investigators reviewed the situation. It was determined that they had not reported it in a timely manner.
The DEA says the pills went missing in 2013 and were not reported to the agency until 2014. The pharmacy is supposed to report it within one business day. According to a statement from the agency, the pills were stolen by employees. The settlement documents say Safeway encouraged unlawful practices by directing pharmacists to report missing drugs only internally. The investigation shows it was happening at five different pharmacies, including the one in Wasilla.
When there's untimely reporting of a significant loss such as this, I mean, it can thwart our investigative efforts. So, you know, we are in the middle of an opioid crisis. It is critical that all involved in the supply and distribution chain do their part.
To settle the broader case, Safeway will pay $3 million directly to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Western District of Washington within 20 days. Stephen Wallace is Bethel's new district attorney. He's the community's third DA in less than 3 years. The court has been operating without one for several months since former DA Mike Gray retired. Wallace started work in Bethel on July 10th, and he says he's familiar with the court's fast pace and high caseload. He has, after all, worked here before. KYUK's Teresa Kotsalorilis reports.
As a young attorney in the 90s, Stephen Wallace landed a job at the Bethel District Attorney's Office. As an assistant DA, he handled a lot of cases, and Wallace was one of only two lawyers working there.
I only had a year under my belt when I came here, so it was very challenging to work here. And it was a tempering process for me, learning about my job as a trial attorney and working in a place that was very busy with very serious things that were happening and trying to deal with them appropriately.
In the years since his stint in Bethel, Wallace has worked all over the state. He started his law enforcement career as a police officer. Most recently, he served as the district attorney in Kodiak, where many years ago, he was the boss of Michael Gray, Bethel's most recent DA. And now, 25 years later, Wallace is back in Bethel and running his old office. He still describes the job as a challenge. The Bethel DA's office is one of the busiest in the state. It's small and understaffed, and Wallace says that over 2,000 cases were referred to them last year.
There are very serious cases that involve crimes against the person, and the number of crimes against the person that occur seems to be as a percentage of the caseload greater than in some other offices I've worked in.
Prosecuting cases in the YK Delta can get particularly complicated. The DA's office tries crimes throughout the Delta's 56 villages, some of which have their own courthouses and law enforcement agencies that the DA needs to coordinate with. In more remote communities, some people may never see the inside of a courtroom, but might appear in court over and over again by phone. According to Assistant Attorney General Rob Henderson, Wallace's approach to these challenges will be informed by his varied work history. Henderson worked with Wallace when they were both young attorneys in Anchorage and has known him for years. He views Wallace's background in police work as an asset.
The way I think it impacts the way he handles his cases is his ability to relate to police officers. He's been on the streets, he's handled cases, and so he knows what that's like.
Henderson added that he's confident in Wallace's ability to train and mentor the young attorneys on his staff. We asked Wallace if there was anything he hoped to address as Bethel's new DA, the crimes he planned to focus on, the internal challenges he hoped to address. He wouldn't go into any details, but he did say he was happy to be back. I'm Teresa Kotsarilis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, high-quality rocketry for kids.
4, 3, 2, 1.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Fishermen are selling more salmon than the Yukon River's only buyer can handle. On Monday, record-breaking sales closed a commercial opening for fishermen upriver. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports those fishermen spent Tuesday watching tens of thousands of dollars swim by during the river's first opportunity to sell king salmon this decade.
District 1 in the lower Yukon River saw its first commercial opening for the fall season on Monday, and Gweekback bought five times its usual amount of fish. Tuesday, the buyer canceled the opening scheduled that evening for District 2.
Everybody got their limits, and we're at our limit physically.
That's Jack Schulteis. He manages Gweekback Fisheries in Ammonic.
We just got close to 500,000 pounds of fish, and you know, we just don't have the capacity to safely handle another opening.
What do you mean by safely handle?
Being able to take the fish to where we're not going to have quality issues or spoilage. And all of our tender boats are loaded up to turn those boats around. It's just too much for us.
The 12-hour opening targeted fall chum salmon, which sold for 60 cents a pound. And for the first time since 2011, any king's cod could be sold as well for a whopping $5.50 per pound. The opening infused hundreds of thousands of dollars into the pocketbooks of fishermen in the lower river. One of those fishermen was Maddie Beans. Beans is from St. Mary's, which is in District 2, where the opening was canceled. The day before, he'd boated with his fishing partner to District 1.
Fishing last night was great. We had about 6 totes of chums, roughly about 4,000 pounds.
And one king salmon. The trip took 4 hours each direction, over 70 miles in harsh weather.
35-mile-an-hour wind with mist rain and hard rain and rain that makes your eyes squint.
Most fishermen in District 2 didn't spend the time and gas going out. They were planning on fishing the following day in their district. When the opening in District 2 of the Yukon was canceled Tuesday, just hours before it was to begin, fishermen upriver who had not made the drive down the day before had no choice but to stay on shore.
None of us are going to be able to fish today.
So how is that going to affect you, not being able to fish tonight?
Well, that's a couple grand we're going to miss out on tonight. It's going to affect us buying some school clothes for the kids, put some more food on the table, you know, stock up on heat and fuel.
The Alaska Fish and Game Department says more openings are likely this season. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Before Bogoslav Volcano started erupting, it was a haven for endangered stellar sea lions, fur seals, and seabirds. But scientists didn't know when or if animals would return to the eastern Aleutian Island.
Biologists are starting to answer that question. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel has more.
Bogoslav volcano has erupted more than 50 times in the last year and is giving no indication of slowing down. This means even though scientists like Tom Gillette would like to set foot on land, they can't. But with powerful camera lenses, they can check for wildlife on the island even from miles away.
And it was interesting because it was still steaming quite a bit, of course. The whole island is covered in ash. But there were sea lions and fur seals all along the shoreline. A lot of animals, a lot of birds.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration biologist was expecting to see animals on Bogoslav.
You know, those animals, they've evolved with volcanoes for a long time, obviously. It's only speculative, but you can imagine that when it starts to rumble and go, those animals that can move just go into the water.
When he passed by, it was the day after an eruption, and there's been more since then. At this point, it's too soon to tell what effects the eruptions will have on animals, but researchers can tell the island has grown in size. If it stays large, Gillette says that could mean more space for stellar sea lions, fur seals, and seabirds to call home. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
The National Transportation Safety Board will conduct an investigative hearing in Alaska on a fatal commercial airplane crash. The NTSB says the investigative hearing next month in Anchorage will be the first in Alaska since the Exxon Valdez wreck in 1989 and the first held outside of Washington, D.C. in nearly 20 years. The hearing will focus on a crash last October that killed two pilots and a passenger near the southwest village of Togiak. The flight was operated by Hagland Aviation Services, Inc., doing business as Raven Connect. The board will gather sworn testimony from subpoenaed witnesses, but will not analyze or discuss the crash. The hearing will begin on August 17th at the Captain Cook Hotel and is open to the public. Alaska Airlines might cut some of its flights between Bethel and Anchorage, which could complicate travel for residents right around the winter holidays. Regional Vice President Marilyn Romano confirmed that a new flight schedule will take effect a few weeks before Thanksgiving and remain in place until just after New Year's. The company says it's upgrading its fleet, trading in its trusty combis for newer planes with more seats. Romano says it might not be cost-effective for them to keep flying those larger planes into Bethel 3 or 4 times a day. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta relies heavily on the flights connecting Bethel to Anchorage. Romano assures residents that Alaska Airlines is approaching their schedule changes thoughtfully and is taking the Delta's needs into account. There aren't any details yet on how many flights could be cut. An incorrect version of the new schedule was added to the Alaska Airlines website several weeks ago, but Romano and others say that it was uploaded by mistake. A finalized schedule is expected later this week. Officials with the Air Force and other agencies are asking members of the public to weigh in on several proposals to provide drinking water to Moose Creek residents who can't use their wells because of groundwater contamination. The pollution came from Eielson Air Force Base's use of firefighting foam in years past. But North Pole City Council members made it clear Monday they believe expanding their municipal water system to Moose Creek is the best alternative. KUIC's Tim Ellis reports.
The North Pole City Council unanimously passed a resolution in Monday's meeting stating its support for expanding the city's water system to Moose Creek because, says Mayor Bryce Ward, it's the best solution to provide drinking water to the community.
Just want to let Air Force know that this is something that if the community is interested in it, the city could be a viable option.
Ward says expanding the water system is the best of 7 alternatives outlined in an Air Force study of the groundwater contamination that's spread from nearby Eielson Air Force Base. The study, which will be presented tonight in a town hall meeting at the Moose Creek Fire Station, also includes other alternatives such as setting up tanks or water filtration systems at each residence or business affected by the contamination. The Air Force's interim feasibility study estimates it'll cost $34 to $40 million to expand the system about 4 miles south to Moose Creek and maintain it over 30 years. Ward says that'll provide water to 169 parcels in the area where 2 types of perfluorinated compounds have been found in groundwater at levels that could harm human health.
Although it is not necessarily the cheapest option, it provides the least amount of liability to those involved and affected.
and the greatest security over that 30-year period and even longer.
The Air Force will pay the estimated $25.3 million to build the system, but the federal government probably will not pay for maintenance and operation of the expanded water system. Ward says North Pole knows quite a bit about that process because for years it's had to deal with a bigger groundwater contamination problem caused by the leakage of sulfalane, an industrial solvent, from the Flint Hills refinery, which the company shut down in 2015. Ward says the city hopes to hire a contractor this year that, if all goes well, will begin work in the spring on a larger water system expansion project for homes and businesses affected by the sulfalane contamination. That project's estimated to cost nearly $100 million, 80% of which will be paid for by Flint Hills. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided for all the training programs, providing students with housing, food, books, and tools. Learn more by calling 1-800-733-JOBS. This message sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
It took more than a year, but in May, Alaska wildlife troopers based in Juneau finally charged seven men with Juneau ties for a slew of hunting crimes and one fishing violation. Troopers say abusive hunters undermine management of the state's wildlife resources, and that investigating and prosecuting more complex cases like these sends a message that it's not okay. KTOO's Quinton Chandler reports.
It's hard to get a hold of Trooper Jake Abbott during the summer. He's just back from a two-week boat patrol between Juneau and Ketchikan. But when he did pick up the phone, he said his investigation report on the seven-man hunting spree was nearly 20 pages. He says they're generally closer to two.
Definitely the most tedious investigation I've had to conduct, as well as the most in-depth and thorough.
In February last year, the wildlife troopers heard a tip that during the 2015 deer hunting season, a group of friends took hunting trips south of Juneau into Stevens Passage near Admiralty Island and to the west into Cross Sound near Elfin Cove. The source said they killed a lot of deer and broke a lot of laws in the process. These aren't people crimes, but Abbott says they're important because they hurt the state's efforts to protect its living resources, and the rules give hunters and fishermen a level playing field. The troopers looked for digital evidence, text messages, and ritual post-hunt pictures. They looked for leftover deer and antlers, and they held a lot of interviews. Abbott says the more they learned, the bigger the case got. One big problem was the group shot deer from a boat, which he says is easier than tracking an animal on land. It's also illegal, unless you're a hunter with a special permit.
People shooting deer from the boat tends to lead to what we call higher wounding loss, which means an animal gets wounded.
The deer might run into the woods, die out of sight, and then that meat is wasted. Abbott says you're also not giving the animal a fair chance. Many times, he says the deer doesn't even realize it's in danger. Abbott says some of the hunters also abused the proxy hunting system. Proxy hunters can stand in for elderly or disabled Alaskans. Both people have to be residents. In this case, Abbott says a resident who was proxy hunting wanted to help his non-resident friend kill more deer without paying for them. Non-residents can take four deer in the areas the group hunted, but they have to buy small wire tags to fix on each deer they kill. In 2015, Abbott says non-resident deer tags cost $150 each. He says if every hunter avoided paying for those tags, there would be a ripple effect.
Number one, we're not getting accurate harvest data back to Fish and Game on who harvested what, where, and when.
Second, Abbott says the Department of Fish and Game gets federal matching dollars from selling tags and hunting licenses.
That purchase gets multiplied by three, and the Department of Fish and Game receives those funds for management of the resource.
Troopers also charged individuals in the hunting party with unlawful possession of game, giving the state false hunting reports, taking too many deer, and illegally catching a halibut. It's unclear how many deer the group killed. Abbott says most of the offenses are misdemeanors. He says members of the group may temporarily lose their hunting privileges. In Juneau, I'm Quentin Chandler.
4th of July celebrations may be over, but that doesn't mean people have stopped firing rockets. Last week, middle school students from across Alaska learned how to design and launch their own rockets at one of University of Alaska Anchorage's summer engineering academies. Alaska Public Media's Henry Leisha attended the final launch.
At the center of a large field, a group of students watches Wayne Robinson remove the parachute from a red, white, and blue rocket. He's worried about wind blowing the rockets into a nearby road on their descent, so he instructs the students to make some last-minute adjustments.
And what that does is it converts this 8-shroud roundish chute into a 4-shroud square chute that's a lot smaller. So the rocket will come down faster.
Robinson, a mechanical engineer, played a big role in developing the curriculum for this year's UAA Summer Rocketry Academy. He has been building rockets since 1962. When he first started out, supplies were hard to come by.
Most of my early rockets were built from scratch, literally to the point of actually rolling the tubes and using tops off of shampoo bottles and so forth for nose cones.
Times have changed. The Summer Academy students get to work with high-quality kits. They even use high-tech modeling software to customize their rockets and see how they will fly before launch.
They started with the basic kit design and then modified it by putting on different nose cones, different fins, trimming the fins down, putting the fins on backwards, and so forth. So we ended up with actually, out of that single kit, a rather wide variety of designs.
Addison Dobbs and Khalid Hodge are two students from Thielen Middle School in Wasilla. They're comparing their designs while waiting for their turn to launch. Both are confident that their rockets will fly high above the clouds, but Khalid thinks Addison's paint job could use some work.
With the spray paint, don't go too close, or you're going to get it dripping like that.
Well, I wanted it like that.
Okay.
The rocketry course is one of 13 offered by UAA's Summer Engineering Academies. The academies offer hands-on instruction in the field of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM. Deanna Flynn, one of the instructors, attended the summer academies herself just a few years ago. She says that the Java programming course she took helped inspire her to pursue a degree in computer science.
These camps are a great opportunity to get kids more involved in the STEM field and seeing great ideas of what you could do in the future.
When the wind dies down, the first group of students step up to the ignition switch. In the distance, behind a few orange cones, their rocket stands on the launch pad. They scan the field and the sky and then begin their countdown.
Going in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Despite the wind and some ominous rain clouds, all 15 rockets were successfully launched by the end of the day. In Anchorage, I'm Henry Leisha.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Anna Rose MacArthur and Teresa Kotsarilis in Bethel, Casey Grove and Henry Leisha in Anchorage, Zoe Sobel in Onalaska, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Quentin Chandler in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Zachariah Hughes produced tonight's show. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a lovely night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Education scholarships and grants for ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, are available. To learn where the possibilities this education can take you, visit beanengineeralaska.com. This community message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil. Energy lives here.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.